Well, we are going to the healthcare town hall.
Yes, sir.
Talking about policy and democracy and...
Hello, everybody. I'm Jeff Horwich. And, you know, I don't get depressed easily by the news. I just don't. And if I did, this show wouldn't be what it is. But I got so bummed out from just watching a few minutes of health reform town halls on YouTube. I don't care, you know, if it's AstroTurf, like they're saying, right, which is fake grassroots, people being farmed into the meetings to make a ruckus, or if this is real or what the proportion is. Either way, this country's got problems. And I know they're not all like this, the town halls, but even the fact that some of them are like this. And this one in particular really got me. Just, I thought, the best portrait of the worst portrait of the depravity and the disinformation going on here. This is John Dingell. He's a congressman from Michigan. He's 83 years old. He's an old guy, you know, tough as nails. I'm sure he's been through this kind of thing many times, but still, he's just like this old dude standing up there at the podium. He can't get a word in, and that just makes the whole thing even sadder. And the meeting has been just complete chaos up to this point. But at one point, a man wheels his son up to the front of the room in a wheelchair, right in the congressman's face, mid-meeting, and the guy just starts screaming.
Under the Obama health care plan, which you support, this man would be given no care whatsoever because he is a cerebral palsy handicapped person.
Oh,
just that short. All right, shut up!
Okay, to recap, the guy is not asking a question or having a conversation at this town hall. He is declaring that the proposed reforms will, in some categorical fashion, eliminate health care for people with cerebral palsy. Now, there are a lot of important questions to ask about the health reform bills, a lot of helpful points to be made, and that, I'm just going to go out on a limb here, that is not one of them. Where do you even go from there? Of course, you hear some other guy from the other side go, shut up, you idiot, right at the end there. Very civic-minded of you, sir. This last week or so feels like South Korean-style democracy, you know, which I might have thought would be exciting, where legislators suddenly come flying over their desks during a debate on some bill and start punching each other in the face. It's like that, except that is a lot more funny than this is. This is not funny at all. This is just sad, Americans. Republicans are now going at these healthcare reform bills with everything they got. It's the new Waterloo. And I'm not going to talk about health reform anymore right now, but while we're on the subject of things that conservative Americans are very angry about, I was flipping through the stations on the radio the other day and found myself listening to, let's just say, not public radio. Stumbled onto a extremely heated discussion, very passionate call-in show discussion about the census. Of course, here in Minnesota, we've got our Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, who has made this something of an issue and put it in the news, but I think it didn't really sink in for me just what kind of legs that concern has until I was listening to this call-in show. So we asked Mitch Berg, a friend of In the Loop, to come on in and talk with me about it in a bit. Mitch hosts Northern Alliance Radio Network here in the Twin Cities. And this wasn't your show, I don't believe, but I'd imagine this topic has come up, right, Mitch?
It has.
How deep does a concern run?
Well, conservatives are, we're famously reticent about giving out personal information to anyone, much less Big Brother, whoever, yeah, mm-hmm. whoever Big Brother may be. And reticence about that sort of has been part of American politics back and forth for as long as I can remember. It depends on your point of view on whether or not you believe government has any business knowing those sorts of things.
So what were the disputes that played out kind of over this winter and spring that set all of this concern about the census really in motion for this go-around?
The two big disputes, one of them has been going on for a decade, the notion of replacing or supplementing the direct enumeration, in other words, the nose-by-nose count of people.
Which is how we think of the census.
Yeah, like a big national roll
knocking
call.
Knocking on doors, yeah.
Exactly. The idea of replacing that with some sort of statistical modeling, some mm-hmm. sort of mathematical prediction of how many people there really are in this country, based on the premise that there are populations in this country that are systematically undercounted, which is seen by certain groups on the right as being a cover for racking up more votes in the inner city, where many of these hypothetically undercounted people remain. The other issue, number two of two here, is a proposal to bring the Census Bureau directly under the control of the White House, in a sense having the direct black line report go from the Census Bureau to Rahm Emanuel, then directly up to the president.
Instead of to the Secretary of Commerce, which is
right.
Where it...
Right. That's the way it's traditionally been done in all of the other censuses. Uh-huh. That's correct.
As I recall, in his confirmation hearing, I think the new census director promised that they're not going to use sampling, right? And, of course, that bid for the White House to take over direct supervision of the census was set aside. Why does the concern persist? It seems like the conservatives who brought up these concerns have won the important battles over the last few months.
Well, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance, and certainly with an election coming up in 2010, it's not in our interest to let these issues necessarily die away. I mean, it's certainly an issue. The census director that Obama did appoint, while he did back off of his stance on the statistical estimate for the census, that is a big part of his background. I mean, that's one of the reasons he was arguably brought into the position in the first place, was his expertise in doing that sort of modeling.
Do you know a lot of people, Mitch, who are refuse to fill out the census form, or maybe just fill out the bare minimum, as Congresswoman Bachman has said?
Do I know a lot of people? I mean, you got to understand, I grew up in North Dakota, around a bunch of survivalists. I mean, I know a lot of people who don't pay their taxes. But if we're talking about my immediate social circle right now,
sure.
I know a lot of people who are highly concerned at a policy level and are going to be watching the census forms very carefully to see how intrusive indeed they are. I don't personally know an awful lot of people who are going to whittle away everything but the constitutionally mandated minimum data that needs to be filled out for the census forms, whatever that may be. But I know a lot of people who are fundamentally sympathetic to Representative Bachman's stance on this and understand why she's doing it.
And you yourself, when you get the census form, what are you going to do?
I am going to find the things that I think they're intrusive and blog about them and bring them up on my talk show for expansive public ridicule.
And then fill them out.
Most likely. I'm a uniter, not a divider.
The government, of course, is charged by the Constitution with carrying out the census. Right. And the Constitution doesn't say a lot about specifically what should be in there.
Right.
Some concern that just all this detailed data gets into the wrong hands, and what happens?
Plenty of concern. I mean, the drafters of the Constitution intended the census to be a tool to be used to help apportion representation, not to be used as a tool to make life better for all Americans. Last November's election gave us, for the next four at least years, an official dominant view that government is here to make life better for all people, and so the census will be a tool, we conservatives believe and are wary, for social engineering rather than just figuring out who represents what part of the country.
And what about all the handy information? I mean, of course, I speak as a journalist. I mean, I've used the census for all kinds of things to just learn about the country and to get the facts and figures that without it are completely unattainable.
The question I would ask in response is it really government's job to be providing you, Jeff Horowitz, with all this demographic information about all of us? And the hardcore conservatives will say no. Those of us on the center right will say, let's be careful what the government is asking of all of us. And there might be places in the census where there is a little bit of pushback needed. I think that's what Representative Bachman is doing largely right now.
Now, there's technically a fine for not responding to the census, not filling out the census form as fully as one should.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense of how that's going to play out in practice? Are fines going to be levied?
I don't have a general sense how many people are nervous about getting hit with a $5,000 fine for not filling out every single iota of the form here.
Is that what it is? $5,000?
$5,000. I looked that up before I came down here. Five grand.
That's
so
big.
I think I'll probably keep my criticism more to the blogging and talk radio sides than the actual activism
not worth
at this
it,
point.
Huh?
That's not at this point, no.
Right.
I've got a paint job that needs to get done. But I can see a fair number of people, Representative Bachman perhaps being one of them, who would be perfectly happy to use this as a test case of some sort to say, okay, I'm not going to fill it out. Come and get me, Census Bureau, because this is political gold for me.
One thing that really hit home for me listening to that the radio show, the Colin show about this, was just how deeply, deeply angry some people are about this. I mean, this makes them really, really mad, not just public officials, but ordinary folks. And I'm thinking about my mother, as a matter of fact, who's taken on part-time work as a census taker, and that's just sort of getting underway. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you can give me a preview of what kind of anger my mother might be encountering behind some of the doors she has to go out and knock on.
Yeah, I don't know that your mother will get anybody going, "The concerned Census Bureau is ruining our life," but I could see a little slop over from the healthcare debate, from all these other issues where people are legitimately concerned about eroding personal liberties and expanding government power. So tell your mother to, you know, wear her running shoes.
Mitch, thanks very much for stopping by to give us a little insight on this.
My pleasure.
All right, that's Mitch Berg, co-hosts Northern Alliance Radio Network, and his blog, where Mitch will be logging his concerns and observations about the census, is called Shot in the Dark. So Sanit and I are sitting around on Tuesday thinking, holy crap, it's Tuesday already. What can we ask people about this week? Sandin, boy genius, he goes, "It's almost back to school time." Brilliant. So pull the trigger on that. Send a little note out to our email list, our network, as we say. Just asking, maybe you're going back to school soon. And what are you seeing? Anybody seeing anything interesting? Heard back from a number of folks, among them Bailey Morris. And Bailey, you're just starting as a student teacher, right, in Sioux Falls, South Dakota?
Yes.
And how's your first day or two going?
It's been pretty good. I've been very nicely welcomed. I think it's going to be better than I imagined.
And how old are you, if I might ask?
22.
Okay, so you just graduated from college and you're heading out into the world and starting your teaching career.
Exactly.
Very cool. You wrote about something that struck you about the open house at the school this week. What did you see?
As I walked through the doors, there was just a sea of shoes sitting out.
Shoes?
Exactly. Waiting for people to pick up if they needed it. Kids, adults, all sizes, all types. There were cowboy boots that I saw, a few Mary Janes.
This is at the open house for your school that you're going to be student
school,
teaching at.
Okay. Exactly.
And so these are donated shoes for people to just take?
Mm-hmm. Yep. As well as free fruit. Booths and booths for like food stamps and things like that, and I just thought it was extremely interesting and really kind of eye-opening to see all of those resources kind of lining up and coming to the school.
So the school open house, it wasn't just about, okay, meet your teachers and here's where you put your backpacks. It became sort of like a catch-all kind of social service fair.
Exactly.
A little bit.
Exactly.
How did it make you feel about the environment where you're about to begin your teaching career?
You know, it actually was more motivating to me. I think you almost feel your sense of purpose strengthening. That's actually somewhat exciting in a very odd way.
Yeah. It sounds like you're in for an exciting year. And congratulations on beginning your career in teaching.
Thank you very much.
It's fun to talk with you, and thanks for writing in.
All right. Take care.
That is Bailey Morris, listener going back to school in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And in this time, in this epic time of creeping socialism, we got an intriguing response from Ben Lund. Ben is about to send his first child off to school in Rochester, Minnesota.
I had noticed that the school supplies that were being requested for my child as he enters kindergarten included the statement at the bottom that said that the school supplies do not need to be marked with their child's name and will be shared and distributed by the teacher.
Well, we checked with the Rochester School District. That is indeed their policy. Maybe that's a fairly common thing. That's the first I've heard of it. But the collectivist nature of it did bother Ben a little bit.
I thought it was important for the children to learn to manage their own supplies. You know, it's just a pretty minor example. You know, school supplies really aren't that expensive, but it's a good way for them to learn how to manage their property. But I did find out later, though, that it is limited to kindergarten, so it may not be quite as invidious as I had first suspected.
Kindergartners in Rochester learning to share and redistribute wealth, whether they like it or not. Thank you very much, Ben Lund, for getting back to us. And while we're in school here, let's have a quick little lesson, because Ben used the word invidious at the end of that last cut of tape, and I actually had to look that up. I wasn't sure if it was a word. It's kind of one of those SAT words, as a matter of fact. It is a word, and let's just check it out as I'm reading off of my computer screen here. Invidious, unjust, unpleasant, tending to rouse ill will, animosity, or resentment. Invidious. Thanks to everybody who got back to us on our back-to-school questions. We're still interested in anecdotes about that. And so if you're not on our network or if you want to answer those questions, go to intheloopshow.net and sign up for the network and send us your thoughts. While we're on this glorious topic of all the wonderful things that our listeners have to share with us, let's do one of our listener news niche segments, shall we? Bonnie Marsick is here with me in the studio. Bonnie, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
And it has been like a year since you came on the show.
Yep.
Bonnie's working on her PhD in neuroscience at the University of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Last time she was here, she had all kinds of cool things to share with us. And I think she's got some nifty things today from generally the neuroscience arena, right?
Yep.
I have the bare notes here and you got to fill in the details. Scientists somewhere are working on actually giving people out-of-body experiences.
Yeah. And the reason that they sort of got this idea was in certain people, like stroke victims, they sort of have this out-of-body experience, or they'll feel like their arm really doesn't belong to them.
It's not just that they can't control it.
They can control it. They feel like it belongs to someone else. It's hard for us to imagine what that feels like, right? But it indicated that maybe there are regions of the brain that are responsible for this. They thought, well, maybe we can kind of induce this sort of illusion in the lab. And the way that they first did this was by taking video cameras and like video goggles and strapping them onto someone, and then strapping the cameras onto someone else. So when the volunteer approached the researcher who was wearing the camera goggles, it looked like they were looking at themselves.
But from a different angle, from outside their body.
Right, from the other perspective.
Okay.
And when they shook the person's hand, they felt like, whoa, this is weird, I'm shaking my own hand.
That would be odd.
Yeah.
If we have found ways that we can make people within their minds leave their bodies, what do we use that for?
Well, there's some really interesting applications this could be used for. One is for doctors doing remote surgeries. So if you think about how difficult it is to like control a robot, if you've ever tried to control something, even like a video game, how much easier it would be if you felt like it was kind of an appendage of your own. Maybe you could have better control over it. Or also the really cool application that could be used for is virtual reality games. So you actually feel like you're in the video game fighting people or something.
I should ask before we move on, you haven't had an out-of-body experience, have you?
No, I haven't. Have you?
No. We could share nifty stories if we had. I think it's a pretty rare thing, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, next item. Half a brain can get you pretty far.
So this recent study came out in PNAS out of a group in Germany. And basically they're describing this.
Is that
girl.
A journal? PNAS or something?
Yes. Proceedings of the National Academy.
Look it up,
of
everybody.
Okay. Yes. And basically this girl, she started having seizures when she was 3 years old. And her parents brought her into the doctor. And what they discovered after doing an MRI was that she had half a brain. One of her hemispheres was missing.
Wow.
After giving her, you know, seizure medication, she actually ends up being pretty well functioning. She's intelligent. She has pretty normal control of everything. And what happened was, they think, is when she was developing really, really early in development in the womb, the one half of her brain stopped developing. But the other half that was remaining ended up being able to sort of compensate and take over for all the other functions that the other half would normally have.
Do you recall whether she had the right half or the left half?
She had the left half.
So what special stuff that happens in the right lobe of your brain she wouldn't inherently
grow
up with?
For the most part, they do similar things. The left side of the brain does a lot of language processing stuff. So she did have the left side of her brain. But the interesting thing about the paper that they were talking about was the visual system. The left visual field is processed by your right visual cortex of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened with her was that her visual system was completely normal, which was the rewiring coolness part.
So if she has only the left hemisphere of her brain, am I getting this right? Would that make her a very analytical personality? Is she lacking the right brain creativity?
Not so much. That's a little bit of a misnomer.
Urban legend kind of thing?
Kind of. The left part of your brain really does do a lot of language stuff, but the creative versus language part, I'm not so sure that's so
bogus.
True.
Just say it. You're the neuroscientist in the room.
I hesitate.
Okay. Let's talk about birds using tools. It's not new information that other animals can use tools. I mean, it used to be this kind of thing that only humans, right, could use tools. But there's some actually really kind of stunning tool use that has come out pretty recently.
Yeah, there's two new studies that came out recently. And these involve the same type of bird family called the Corvidae family. So it's like jays, ravens, rooks, crows, those types of birds.
Mm, they seem like smart birds, I would think.
There's actually some previous research that was interesting with crows. They would stand on overpasses, drop nuts onto the road underneath and allow cars to crush the nuts. And then when the light turned red, they would go down and get the contents. It's really interesting.
Is that one of the new ones?
No, that's a previous research.
Okay, what are the new ones?
The first one involved rooks. And they would use a tall glass of water and they have a worm floating in it.
Yum.
Yes. And they put it in the cage, and the rooks were able to figure out that they could use rocks to drop into the glass of water and bring up the level so that they could gain access to the floating worm.
Very smart. Okay. And what was the other amazing bird feat?
The other one involved crows, and this one was really cool. So they had sequential tools. So they have a tool that the crows would have to use to get access to another tool, and then use that tool to gain access to a third tool, which they could then use to get access to a piece of food. And this one's really interesting because there's a lot of speculation about whether or not crows are planning ahead, or if they're just doing this thing called chaining, where the first tool elicits the behavior for the second tool, which, you know, elicits the behavior for the third tool. So they're not really sure which one's going on.
All right, and one last thing I want to ask you about, mm-hmm. the medicinal properties of blue M&Ms. Just the blue ones?
Just the blue ones, yeah.
Wow. Okay, what's the deal?
There's two kind of main factors I need to talk about with spinal cord injury. One is that, you know, the neurons, we need to get them to regrow. But the other thing, they know that once the spinal cord injury happens, this molecule called ATP floods into the area and kills whatever neurons are remaining alive there, the motor neurons. And they figured out that this blue dye, it's called Brilliant Blue, and it's in Gatorade and M&Ms, binds to the receptors and blocks the binding of this ATP to the receptors and
prevents this damaging
right,
substance.
And prevents the further damage that happens.
Who has this idea in the first place? Who thinks, gosh, I wonder if this blue stuff we use to color our food might have something to do with spinal cord injury.
Well, these studies come out and it looks like they just sort of stumbled upon it. But there was actually a lot of research that happened before this. One was that they figured out that ATP was involved and that they could block these receptors with other molecules. The reason they came across the blue dye was that molecularly and structurally, it's similar to the molecule they were using before. And they wanted something that they could just inject into the veins, because before they were injecting this blocker directly into the spinal cord, which isn't very practical. And the really funny side effect that happened with this was they were using albino rats, mm-hmm. and their ears and their eyes and their noses would turn blue for a certain time afterwards. They look really cute.
Bonnie, this is really interesting stuff. Thanks for coming by, and let's do it again sometime.
Thank you.
That's Bonnie Marsick. She's a listener of our show here in the Twin Cities, and she is in her fifth year, very close to getting her PhD in neuroscience at the University of Minnesota. If you've got a news niche that you might want to come in and talk with us about, find us at intheloopshow.net or loopfacebook.net and shoot us a note. Now, sometimes it feels like it just wouldn't be a proper episode of In the Loop if we weren't trying to put a phone call in to some far-flung part of the world. And we were getting curious again about Zimbabwe because it kind of had fallen out of the headlines, and we followed it fairly closely back when things were really on edge there. 6 months ago now, just about, President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai resolved their big election dispute, well, sort of, and entered into a power-sharing government with Tsvangirai as prime minister. When we've wanted to check in on Zimbabwe over the past year or so, we've crossed our fingers for a good phone line and put a call in to Terence Mashinga-Idze. He lives in Bulawayo, which is the country's second largest city. Terence, how have you been?
Well, I'm okay. I'm surviving in Zimbabwe.
That's good news. Has life gotten much better for you and around you, would you say, in the past 6 months?
Yeah, I think things have improved over the past 6 months since the formation of the government of national unity between President Mugabe and Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai. And among the things that has improved, the availability of basic commodities in the shops.
When you go out to the shops, what can you find now that you couldn't find before? How much easier is it?
Before, there was literally nothing in the shops. Literally nothing. So most people would go to neighboring countries, especially Botswana and South Africa, to get basic commodities, sugar, milk. But now these commodities are available locally. So what I can say right now, the problem is that the salaries are too low, because most government workers are earning between $100 and $180 a month, not enough for groceries or other things that people need in their daily living.
Why are the salaries so low?
A number of factors contribute to that, but I think the major factor is that the government does not have money right now, because the money that the government is getting is through taxes. And the government's revenue base right now is still very small.
And one big factor here, I imagine, is that one thing the MDC, the former opposition, has accomplished is throwing out the Zimbabwean dollar, which is horribly, ridiculously inflated. And now everything happens in U.S. dollars, which I guess means that everybody's salaries can't be inflated either.
Oh, yes, yeah, because the government decided to use multiple currencies. So the American dollar, and also the South African rand. and the Botswana Pula. So these are the currencies that are being used. And also one thing you should be, we need to notice that the government is not getting much in terms of budgetary support from the international community, because the international community is still skeptical about the power arrangements right now.
You have been for many years a supporter of the MDC. Are you skeptical of the arrangement and how it's working in Zimbabwe?
Yes, I'm a bit skeptical because some of the things that the MDC wanted to be incorporated into the governance of the country has haven't been implemented. And also another thing is that of late, a number of MDC MPs have been arrested.
Right, indeed. For sometimes kind of, I don't know, silly things, right? Like one guy for stealing a cell phone, supposedly?
Yes, like stealing a cell phone. Something like 5 MPs right now are either on trial or have been convicted. And many people suspect that this is a ploy by the ZANU-PF to reduce the MDC's dominance in the parliament.
One of the really striking ones that I saw was an MDC member of parliament who was arrested for allegedly playing an anti-Mugabe song in his car. Is there a lot of politically charged music around?
Yeah, people do listen to such music, and also some of the music is played in public transport vehicles.
They can get away with that?
Yeah, it depends. Sometimes people can play their music in their own cars, but of course, there's a need for caution. For example, when one approaches, say, roadblocks that are manned by the police, at times people reduce the volumes of that music, stop the music as they talk to the police, but once they are driving on the road, they play it.
Hillary Clinton took a long trip to Africa this week. She didn't go to Zimbabwe. Maybe it's just a little bit sensitive for her to drop by right now, but do you think her being in the area has had much of an effect on the outlook for your country?
I think the visit in the region was good in the sense that it kind of exerted pressure on the South African government to do something about Zimbabwe.
Do you feel good about Jacob Zuma, the new president in South Africa, that he will take a stronger hand with Robert Mugabe?
I think he will be better than the previous South African president, Thabo Mbeki, who tried to monitor the ZANU-PF government. But, of course, we are yet to see his approach. I understand he's going to get into Zimbabwe. He will be coming to Zimbabwe maybe next week or very soon.
What kind of welcome can he expect in Zimbabwe when Jacob Zuma comes?
Well, I'm not so sure about people's attitude towards him. But I think we'll see the approach he's going to take about Zimbabwe within the next 1 month or so.
Over the past year, when we've talked to you from time to time, you've been very forthcoming about what's happening in Zimbabwe. And it's a thing that many people wouldn't feel comfortable doing over the phone, the kinds of things that you relate to us, which seem rather mundane, maybe perhaps to in the American context, but you know, it's a serious thing what you do, telling us what's happening. Have you ever really been worried about that, and are you worried now?
The last thing I was a bit worried, but of course, in my analysis, I try to be impartial, and I think there's a bit of tolerance right now in the political space. I mean, in society in general, because right now, foreign media has been accepted back into the country, such as CNN and BBC. So there's a little of tolerance right now, but we don't know how it's going to last.
Well, it sounds like there's at least some good news to share, and I'm glad to hear that. Terrence, thanks very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
That's Terrence Mashinga Idze. He's talking with me from Bulawayo, Zimbabwe. And thanks, everybody, for bearing with us through those excellent Zimbabwean phone lines. What we don't share with you through the miracle of our technology here is the marvelous 3-second delay that exists whenever I'm talking to Terrence. Well, let's end our show here today in another far-flung part of the globe. And I guess we'll continue our musical theme from last week of Americans who find themselves stranded and imprisoned in dictatorial hermit regimes. This week, I was thinking about this guy, John Yetaw. And if that name doesn't ring a bell, his circumstances probably will. This is the guy who decided to go for a midnight swim to the compound of Aung San Suu Kyi in Myanmar or Burma, depending on your inclination. This all led, as you're probably aware, to sentences the other day for the both of them, another 18 months at least of house arrest for Suu Kyi, and 7 years, including a number of years of hard labor, in prison for John Yetta from Missouri. And so that's where he is and will be for the foreseeable future. Secretary of State Clinton issued a statement calling for his release, but statements don't usually get you that far with closed-off military juntas. The story of John Yetta has just got so many twists and turns and so much mystery to it that just felt like a little sort of a classic folky ballad treatment might apply. So I took the guitar into the studio here for a little bit and laid down a tune for him. Well, I've seen lots of things, you know, but I ain't never saw a story quite so tragic as old John Yetta. Just what was on his mind when he dove into that lake? Sure, he never thought so much would come of his mistake. But John, John, what were you thinking? What set off your fateful crusade? You're a good Mormon, we know, so can't chalk it up to drinking. Were you nervous, John? Were you afraid when you pulled on those flippers you made? Was it visions of death? Was it trauma and grief? Was it a mission of peace that inspired your belief? They're holding you now in a jail called Insane. Have you got your own prison that goes by that name? And John, oh John, what was your plan? What message did you hope to send? What thoughts can so harness the soul of a man? Well, you're sentenced now, and how will it end? Bill Clinton can't do that again. Well, it's good to have passions and visions and schemes and teachers who tell us to follow our dreams. But if you've got no one to pull you back from the brink, you might change the world, just not how you think. The Ballad of John Yetta. Always kind of interesting for me to see what musical influences come out in the wash after I finish one of these things. This one definitely has a John Gorka quality to it, I think. Anyway, that's it for In the Loop for this particular episode. We are produced by Sandin Totten and me, and I will just mention one parting note that he and I both are going to be on vacation next week, not together, but we'll both be away taking this opportunity to just catch our breath a little bit. I believe we're going to bring you a rebroadcast of our very first episode, because, in fact, that was 4 years ago this summer. And since Sandin and I will be away, we thought that'd be an interesting opportunity to just kind of give you a glimpse into the now pretty distant past. Listen for that. Hope you enjoyed today's episode. And please keep in touch with us and look for new stuff coming up in the weeks ahead. I'm Jeff Horwich, and I'll talk to you next time I hit record.